Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I'd like to talk a little bit today about Syria and Israel and what's happening between them as the Syrian civil war continues, and maybe just for a little dash of spice, we'll throw in some Benghazi at the end. But Jim, the main thing was the airstrike in Israel, or not in Israel, but in Syria that happened, and how it got revealed that Israel was involved in that. What all went down there?
Well, Israel is playing it very coy on their airstrikes. For one thing, they have long had the ability to basically get around whatever air defense systems the Syrians have had. And you basically only do that by not letting the guy know exactly how you're doing it. We've mentioned a few things that they have, but, you know, as we usually do when you get into OPSEC, operational security territory, you know, we just get kind of opaque. So they do not want to give out too much. What's really interesting about their airstrikes and the increased shooting on the in the Golan Heights on the border is Syrians are doing this, are taking this and trying to spin it as Israeli support for the rebels, because the line that Assad has been taking along with his Russian and Iranian friends is that the whole rebellion is nothing but an attempt by Islamic terrorists to set up another sanctuary by taking over Syria, which may or may not happen. And Assad says, "Look, I'm the lesser of two evils." He doesn't put it that way, but that's what it comes down to. So far, the Europeans and us and, you know, most of the West have not taken the bite, taken the bait. And it's actually kind of pathetic, you know, as we did a piece on Israel today, and I point out that if Syria really wanted to get Israel involved, you know, like Saddam did back in 91, the Israelis do want to defend themselves, and they will basically, you know, bite their tongues, as it were, when attacked in a situation like this. But if the Syrians really wanted to push this, they have a lot of ballistic missiles, you know, those Scuds, and they could just let go with a bunch of those. There's nothing stopping them. They fired several dozen at their own people, killing mostly women and children, which is why they haven't done it a lot more. But of course, the reason they don't do that is the Syrians are not sure if the Israeli anti-missile defenses will or will not work. And of course, if you're a shrewd operator, as the Assad family has been for decades, you do not underestimate Israeli technology. And even if they did get a few missiles through, you know, hit Tel Aviv or whatever, the Israelis would love an opportunity to go in there and go after all those missiles. You know, and that, ironically, that would not really help the rebels much at all. You know, it's not a missile war. In fact, people were surprised when they fired off a bunch of Scuds and other ballistic missiles they had, basically out of desperation. And that was a public relations disaster, because basically they didn't have precise targets to aim them at. And these were guided ballistic missiles, although the Scuds' accuracy is rather questionable. And they basically mostly killed civilians, which provided, you know, really unpleasant photo ops, you know, for the Assads. So Israel is basically, you know, saying outright that we're not supporting the rebels. Although the rumor intelligence, the roommate, as they say, has it that the Israelis have opened up some communications, you know, with some of the rebel groups, because obviously Israel and the mainstream, you know, rebels, the ones that the West likes to deal with, have common cause in making sure that the Islamic terrorist groups, which are still a minority among the rebel fighters, do not play a large role in a post-Assad, you know, Syria. And that's still up in the air. I think no matter which way it eventually falls, the Islamic radicals and conservatives will be prominent. I mean, that's happened in every other Arab Spring country. There's no keeping them out because that is the essential problem in the Muslim world. Religion plays a much larger role in public life than in any other culture. That's something the Muslims like to play down. You know, unfortunately, there's so much evidence piling up. No matter how many billions of dollars of oil money you throw at public relations firms and lobbyists to make it go away, you know, it's a bloody mess, literally and figuratively. And I've spoken with many, you know, Muslims, you know, bicultural Muslims, as I call them, you know, in New York City and up and down the East Coast. And they'll admit it. They says, look, what are you going to do? He says, people back there in the ninth century, and when I go home, I have to deal with it. You know, you kiss their butts and do various other unpleasant things because they will kill you. So the Islamic world has to fix that problem. But in the meantime, like we see in Pakistan with, you know, Waziristan, Somalia until recently, when they do get a sanctuary, they use it. And people die, usually a lot of local people, but people in the West as well, as that poor soldier up in Britain the other day, you know, got hacked up, you know, by a couple of apparently legal, you know, residents in Britain. But Britain has done surveys and they found out that, you know, a substantial minority of their Muslim population, immigrant population largely, same thing in Europe, are all for, you know, religious violence. So what's happening in Syria is Assad is trying to play this Israeli attempt to keep, you know, advanced weapons, you know, the anti-ship missile, mostly Russian missiles, and anti-aircraft and missiles from getting to Hezbollah. And that's all the Israelis are doing at this point. And so that's why the Israelis haven't been running daily airstrikes. In fact, over the last few days, they've been running air practice, as it were, you know, warplanes, F-16s, what have you, flying over southern Lebanon, over Hezbollah territory, which apparently, from what I've heard, you know, looked like practice, you know, for sending in planes, you know, for using smart bombs to make a major attack against Hezbollah, which is partly training, but also it's a message to Hezbollah. It says, look, you haven't got those fancy missiles yet. We can still fly here whenever we want. Well, we can drop smart bombs at any altitude, so forget about your heavy machine guns. You are still ours, and you're going to suffer big time if you try with the rockets. Although Hezbollah is apparently staging thousands of their best fighters to go into Syria. They already have a bunch of them fighting over a border town about 10 kilometers from the Lebanese border with the along with the Syrian army, and that could get really ugly. But again, Israel's only going to get involved if their interests are directly involved. And that's as far as it's going to go.
Yeah. Now, Austin, I've seen pictures of Israeli troops crossing over into Syria and I think Lebanon. How is Hamas and Hezbollah playing into all of this?
Where have you seen pictures of Israeli troops going into Syria, Sam?
It was actually on one of the news reports. They were standing at the border. I think it was Fox News.
Well, standing at the border and entering Syria, the implication of it is they had an operation going. I hadn't read that, but, you know, border surveillance is a different issue. Look, the Israelis are very interested in seeing Hezbollah lose. And there are all kinds of ways for Hezbollah to lose, Dan. They're interested in seeing them lose missiles and rockets, and that's one of what Jim's describing, going after the weapons dumps or the weapon transfer facilities in Syria. But I think the Israelis see the involvement of Hezbollah in the Syrian civil war on the side of Assad's forces as an opportunity to gain some political traction with the other factions that have been browbeaten by Hezbollah, the other other Lebanese factions. I mean, and you take a look at who I'm talking about here. Sunnis, Christians, some of the other minority factions, the Druze as well. Alliances shift in Lebanon rather constantly. But with the growth of Hezbollah, and that growth was spurred by Al-Quds, the Iranian special forces, Iranian intelligence, and Iranian money, and had changed the political calculus within Lebanon. And that's in the wake of Hezbollah wasn't strong, but in the wake of Beirut Spring. And recall, you know, Beirut Spring 2005, but the movement within Lebanon to drive the Syrians out and the like, but then it spiked in 2006 with the rocket war, and the rocket war was essentially a proxy war run by Iran on the Israelis. But it was also used as an opportunity by Hezbollah and Iran to assert and gain power within Lebanon. Well, now that Hezbollah is overtly intervening, and of course it's because their paymasters are bringing them into the fight, paymasters being Iran and primarily, and then Syria secondarily. Here, this is exposed. You're now fighting other Arabs. You're now, there's a sectarian dimension to it, since Hezbollah is a Shia organization, but you're fighting other Arabs. You're also fighting the will of, you know, public will of Arabs that want to toss off a heinous dictatorship. So when I said what you asked me, really, you know, what are the Israeli interests in here? And, you know, I was picking up that you wanted to see what with Hezbollah. I think that's something that how is that being operationalized by the Israelis? I'm not quite sure. But I do know that they see a political opportunity. Wait a minute. I can't answer that on operationalized. I think they are getting very good intelligence from Syrian sources. And I'm not sure where they are. This is in speculation, Dan. Syrian sources about supplies going to Hezbollah. And part of that is from sources that favor the rebels, want to stop Hezbollah intervention, and understand that weakening Hezbollah, if the Israelis weaken them, that to their benefit.
Now, is Hamas going to get stirred up at all during this?
Are you asking me that, Dan?
Yes.
Hamas is always stirred up. The question is about what role are they capable of playing. Hamas and Egypt down in Gaza are having some issues that, and it has to do with Egypt's internal situation, and also some action by some Islamist extremists and going after Egyptian security personnel, Egyptian police, but I understand they weren't all simply police. The West Bank situation between Fatah and Hamas is, at that moment, at a moment from what I can tell, it remains, of course, they're at odds with one another, situations unsettled, but the Syria is where the big game is right now. Jim may have something he can add to that about Hamas.
Hamas is in a very difficult situation. Until the Arab Spring, they were a major recipient of Iranian and Syrian aid. Well, basically, it was Iranian money. There were Syrians involved as well, and basically the Iranians had not coerced, but they'd encouraged the Syrians to give all possible assistance to the Hamas headquarters, which has for decades been based in Syria, like many terrorist organizations. You know, it's like some of them are based in Europe, where they, you know, apply for asylum and what have you. But a lot of them feel more comfortable for any number of reasons in Syria, and the Syrians were happy to have them. Some used to be in Iraq as well. When the Arab Spring began, you had a situation where Iran would not criticize, they encouraged all the other rebels, but not the Syrian rebels, because the government in Syria is run by the Alawite minority, and the Alawites are sort of, you know, sort of Shia. Actually, on a good day, the Iranian clergy would just as soon, you know, condemn the Alawites as heretics and kill them. But, you know, the enemy of my enemy is whatever. And
he just said is totally true. It really is.
But, right. But this put Hamas into a very difficult situation, because they have been making speeches and you know, their media have been pushing this, you know, our friends, the Iranians. And then you have this disconnect, because most Palestinians are all for the rebellion in Syria, even though Syria had long hosted many Palestinian nationalist organizations. But the Palestinians are Sunni. So it just goes to show you how important, you know, that minor difference. I mean, to us it's minor, to a lot of Muslims it's not so minor, you know, between Syrians and Sunnis and Shia. And this became a major, you know, crisis in the last, it ended really a year ago when the Hamas basically said, gee, we love your money, but we can't support your position, Mr. Iran. You know, for a while the money was cut off entirely, but now it's come back on. They've agreed, you know, to disagree. But technically, Hamas is a pro-rebel in Syria. They cracked down on Shia missionaries that Iran had sent in, who were basically going around trying to convert, you know, Sunni Palestinians to Shia. Now, again, religion is not a big deal among the Palestinian people, like it is with most people in the Middle East. You know, you only hear about the conservatives and the radicals. But the Palestinians who are into religion, you know, I'm saying, no, the Shia stuff, let's take a look. You know, they got, you know, the Shia running Iran, which is pretty cool. But when it all comes down to, when push comes to shove, most of the money, aid money that, you know, non-Western aid money that Hamas gets are from Sunni Arab countries in the Persian Gulf, oil-rich countries. They used to get a lot of money from Saddam Hussein, which is, even though he rules over a Shia majority, he himself was a big-time Sunni. So Hamas turned away. In fact, it got so bad that the decades-long, you know, residence of the Hamas high command in Syria ended, and they moved it. So basically Hamas is technically a friend of Iran, but technically an enemy of the Assad's in Syria. So there, in a nutshell, is Middle Eastern politics.
Now, it looks like Syria has backed off of using the chemical weapons that they started to use, Austin, or what has happened with the chemical weapon issue there?
All right. The best clarity that Prime Minister Erdogan's press statement that Turkey was certain the Syrian government had crossed the line. Erdogan gave this, made a public press statement, but he also talked to a couple of reporters directly. And in that press statement, he said, our intelligence, military intelligence, and our medical aid people have confirmed that the Syrians used, and he said, a chemical weapon, and he said they were delivered, now the translation into English, Dan, said 200 missiles, but based on the description within the articles, and one of these actually was in a the English language edition of one of Turkey's major newspapers. It seemed pretty clear to me that they were Russian 122 millimeter rockets is what they had delivered them in. Now, what can those rockets carry? Hydrogen cyanide, AC? I don't think there was indication that it was hydrogen cyanide used. That's extremely volatile. It goes off very quickly, like gas. what, and this was not in Prime Minister Erdogan's interview or his statement, but in some of the other Turkish press speculation, was is that it was GB sarin nerve, and you can put GB, there's a way to put GB in 122 millimeter rockets. There's a nozzle adaptation for it that apparently the Iraqis developed on their for the, their rocket supplies in the 1980s. Now, and then Erdogan said that up to 200 of these were used. All the other allegations, Dan, because it seems pretty clear that chemical weapons of some type were used in some situation. There were allegations that the rebels had used them, and that showed up in some, actually, a discussion among some United Nations organizations. But those, I think, are the best information sources that I've given the most credence to. And there was another article I read, too, about the Turkish medical aid people in seeing what they called wounds associated with chemical weapons and people suffering from what they said were associated with the kind of symptoms you have if you had been exposed to chemical weapons. It did not say GB sarin in that, though.
Okay. Have there been any other incidences besides
that? I haven't seen any. And notice I have avoided saying, quote unquote, the date they were used or the location they were used. I have not. Right. I have not seen that referenced. And the reason I spent more time with Prime Minister Erdogan is because he read what he said. He said, "We believe, we know they've been used." That's what he said. Now, does this count as extensive use, sufficient use to have crossed a red line? Well, it depends. We had some politicians saying that just the use of chemical weapons was a red line. So, anyway.
Okay.
One American official said that recently that there appears to have been two minor attacks. In other words, one was in the north. Actually, I think both were generally around Aleppo. The thinking is that this was a test. Let's see what we can get away with here. Because obviously, the Syrians have a large arsenal. They got tanks, they got artillery, they got chemical weapons. They have missiles and what have you. They've tried everything to see if it would be a game changer. And none of their special weapons, shall we say, like the missiles and the chemical weapons, have made a tremendous difference. The main problem being is that the rebels are basically among civilians. It's not that they are using civilians as human shields, although that's the practical effect in many cases. And the Syrian army recognizes this in several recent situations. They basically drop leaflets over an area where they're going to launch a major attack, which was, basically the rebels could see it was coming. You see vehicles moving and what have you. There are telltale signs. And they basically tell civilians, get out. And here are a couple routes that we will not fire on, so you can get out. And a lot of them do leave, but a lot of them stay. For one, they don't trust the Assads, whatever. And when they use special weapons like ballistic missiles, or chemical weapons, you're going to basically mostly kill civilians, and that's going to provide photo opportunities because everybody's got their cell phone cameras, and even though the internet's been shut down for about 30 or so hours so far in the last few weeks in Syria, it gets out. And that hurts the Assads because the Assads are paying a lot of attention to the information war. And these chemical weapons aren't helping them in that department. Yeah. Again, the tentative use of chemical weapons has allowed the Americans, much to the relief of the Syrians, the Assads, to basically say, well, that didn't quite push us over the red line. We're teetering on it, but, if they, in effect, saying to them, don't use it again because we're right on the goddamn line. You don't want us to attack. We don't want to attack. All the unsaid things. at least publicly against, I think. But that's what's going on. And, you know, me and Austin especially, we have a lot of people down, you know, down in Washington. We've been listening to this nonsense for years, decades. That's how it works. It's not that mysterious. You know, that's why Strategy Page has a large audience, because people realize, you know, these guys, you know, Austin, how many times have people, you know, from the Beltway told you, how do you guys think about that? Experience. If you hang around long enough.
Well, some of it, and Dan, this is something that both Jim and I, this differentiates us from a lot of other sources, is that we'll tell you it's speculation and deduction and indications. And I mean, and Jim's pretty free too with about some of the sources he gets. I mean, all the war gamers around the world that are fans of Jim's work, they're pretty astute folks when it comes to understanding the critical elements of an intelligence report, and these people, business people, are all around the planet. But the thing is, note, you know, Jim did name, he said UFA, and one of the Turkish medical reports I read said northern Syria. Okay, we don't have a total intel spot report of where this stuff was used. But I'll tell you what, just to show you why, when Jim says it was a test, and Prime Minister Erdogan said that there were 200, he says missiles, but, you know, 200 rockets. There, the BM-21, which is a rocket, you know, a truck-mounted rocket launcher, can handle, I think it's two dozen, 122 millimeter.
Yeah.
There's actually a smaller one that's got 12, but two dozen. So if it's, look, if they've got two dozen of them, six of them fire 144. In other words, one battery, there could be four to six of these things. So they fired one battery volley, and that's 144 or 150 missiles. That would be 200 in a report like this. I'm giving you speculation, Dan, but it's speculation based on knowing systems, knowing what they could put on it, and knowing, hey, wait a minute, they didn't flat out go and launch an all-out chemical war. It was in, as Jim says, oh, they were pushing the line. They had a political element to it. So one battery volley. There's your 144 missiles right there, or maybe two battery volleys if it was smaller ones. It was a test. Now, that's what I've just given you, is what Jim means by experience. We could be wrong, but I think you've got something explanatory given the evidence that has been provided by the open press.
Right. And that brings me to what I want to sort of wrap up with, is this dash of Benghazi to spice things up here a little bit. But I want to approach it a different way, because everybody's approaching it from a top-down sort of view. I want to approach it from a bottom-up, often like we do here, is what is our force structure in the Med? I thought I had a clear understanding of sort of what it was, but I want to solidify it. I know we have troops in Italy, right? We have an airborne battalion.
Actually,
there, is that correct?
It's moving out of Italy, but I think it's still there.
Okay.
173rd, yeah.
All right. Where
it's 173rd is a brigade, but
yeah.
It basically
okay.
has a airborne battalion task force. It may have, at one time we had almost two battalion equivalents there, but and back in the 70s and 80s, it was the 509th Airborne Task Force,
right,
at Vicenza, and it was essentially a super reinforced airborne battalion.
Who has a wonderful history from World War II.
Oh, absolutely, 509th. Yeah.
Yeah. What about are there any other Army or Marine units around the Med?
Transitory. The Navy can get basically a reinforced Marine battalion in there, you know, one of their standard task forces, fairly quickly, and they come and they go. And when one of them shows up, it means somebody back in the Pentagon says, you know, we might need these guys. They are there intermittently, although
okay.
these days they're mostly showing up in the Persian Gulf, which is still considered a bigger danger zone than Syria. Right.
But occasionally you'll, I mean, we've put photos up of them of the LHDs.
Yeah.
They're in. Now, do they keep a aircraft carrier in the Med at all times?
No,
or
not anymore.
Okay.
They used to.
But, okay, but it now, I've heard that there were troops for some reason in Spain, that keeps coming up, that there were forces in Spain that could have responded to Benghazi.
There's air forces in there, and of course the special forces can be moved around. They are moved around regularly, but these are small, you know, units. They basically train to fly in somewhere on 2 hours' notice. You know, they can be anywhere within 24 hours, something going down or less. And yes,
right.
And there were apparently detachments of special forces in Italy and in Spain at the time the Benghazi thing going on. In fact, I believe they're still holding, you know, studies and hearings and what have you. But what they're going to talk about is something that is not unusual. These detachments are always in motion, as it were. And it doesn't take much planning or much effort. You pick up a phone or send an email, and you can have one, you know, slotted to, you know, Italy, where these guys don't mind spending a week, you know, waiting for something to happen. The main bases in Spain are naval and air force. We basically haven't got a lot of ground forces in the Mediterranean anymore. And like I said, the 173rd is being moved out of Italy. We basically rely on the Marines.
Right.
As we have for
now, apparently,
years.
There were, from the way it sounds, that there may have been an A-team in Tripoli at the time. Because they keep talking about a special forces unit that was told to stand down, and it doesn't sound like it was a lot of guys, so it sounds like maybe they had an A-team there.
Yeah.
You know, it's curious that they told them to stand down.
That's the political aspect of this whole thing.
Right, yeah. And now the thing is that I keep hearing from some of the talking head generals on TV that they keep mentioning an extremist force. What is the extremist force?
In Benghazi?
Well, anywhere. They make it sound like there's a rapid response force that's labeled extremist that should have been able to respond to.
Oh, well, the State Department has its own security division. And it's got some guys who are basically commandos, you know, advanced SWAT, whatever you want to call them. They know how to fight. A lot of them are former military. And they can also be sent on short notice. There are a lot of these small detachments around, and they're constantly being moved around. So it's not like they're based anywhere. As these hearings go on, they're going to be discovered because these guys, their movements are generally kept secret. Because they do broadcast a certain message to certain enemies, and you don't really want to, you know, let people know, you know, where they are and
right.
Or where they're going. But just knowing where they are can make some people nervous. And you don't want to sacrifice the element of surprise. So that is not unusual. So that's how the news can be deceiving. It always annoyed me, you know, back in the 90s and the, you know, until about 5 years ago when I did a lot of that, how they're always looking for the excitement, not the truth.
Right.
The truth is mundane, and the news is right. All about excitement. I understand that. I always have. But basically, they confuse the issue, you know, by saying, oh, there was a special forces unit there. Well, big deal. They're always somewhere in the Mediterranean. So, you know,
right.
What's the problem?
Yeah, well, I guess what we'll have to find out from the hearings, if we find out, is, you know, where they were they able to respond, why weren't they responding? But until they get down to that level, we're really not going to know anything. Until they actually get down to, you know, the troop commander level, I don't think we'll know much about what the capabilities were at the time. Now, the one thing that has come up, Austin, in different places on the internet.
AC-130 Spectre gunships? Is that where you're going?
No, I'm going to the Benghazi-Syria connection. That the reason that Ambassador Stevens was in the area that he was in was to help solidify some deals to take weapons that were used in Libya
and
transport them to Syria.
That was a CIA operation, basically twofold. One, they were trying to dislocate and, if possible, secure, you know, keep out of the gun runners' hands. A lot of the weapons which had been looted out of the Libyan warehouses, you know, during the Civil War. But at the same time, yes, there was apparently a plan which worked in, up to a point where they bought some of these weapons. I mean, this is not the first time we have done that. We went into Afghanistan, you know, in the after it was all over, and we bought up a lot of our like missiles, the shoulder fired anti-aircraft missiles, things like that. We were doing the same thing in Libya, and a lot of those weapons were just being turned around and shipped off to Syria, you know, again through a third party, through one of the Arabs who are states who are actively bringing weapons in, and that was apparently why the ambassador was in Benghazi. Because he was obviously, you know, the State Department and the embassy there provided cover for the significant number of CIA operatives and paramilitaries who were actually on the ground, you know, doing the work.
Yeah, and even though Ambassador Stevens was in the State Department, if you look at his history, he has been around some interesting places during his career. So
anybody who rises up, you know, in the State Department has to learn to get along with the CIA, because every embassy, especially the large ones in hotspots, has a a local CIA detachment, and they've always operated under diplomatic cover, which annoys a lot of people in the State Department. But again, if you want to go up into the SES, into the senior ranks, you got to learn to work with that.
Right. Austin, do you want to add anything to the Benghazi-Syrian connection or what's going on there, and we'll wrap it up with you?
I really don't. I think I'm going to do something real time here. While Jim was giving an answer on Benghazi, just to check, because I knew I'd seen a video online of a Syrian BM-21. I picked it up. It was the one that was online. Looked to be the BM-21 that can fire 40 rockets. And even though it said on the the Syrians have the BM-21 types with the 12 rocket tubes, the one that was in the picture, I tried to count it, looked like a 4x10. So that, you know, it's one of the 40 rocket ones. Anyway. Point is that they've got that capability, and the Syrians do. Dan, the last thing I would say about Benghazi is that we definitely do not have all of the details about on the ground potential support, where it was, where it could have been. Some of that could be legitimately classified and remain classified. We don't want to give away hints about American operational capabilities, but what really remains unanswered is chain of command issue about who said who gave the order to stand down and not make some attempt during the 7-hour long firefight that occurred that night. We don't know.
Right. Yep. Well, we'll wrap it up there, and it's been a. I think this has been one of the best 45 minutes we've done in a while, guys. So we'll talk to you next time.
Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.